This is my presentation on statelessness and figurative and non-figurative image making through painting. I'm just going to be talking about two different methods of carefully looking at locations and the different things that each approach has to offer. First of all, I'm starting from the point of view that to see is to be physically touched by photons that bounce off of something that then touch your eyes. I spend a lot of time thinking about the physical aspect of things, most notably, if for those who are interested, the book Theory of the Image by Thomas Nail has impacted my thinking a lot on this. Also, when you look at things and they affect you, your mind being affected by that is a physical thing. And I mean, this may not seem that relevant to people, but I just wanted to mention that off the bat. To be in a place, you cannot, I believe, physically be somewhere without altering that place and also being altered by it on a physical level. I'm primarily going to be talking about land and how a state is, among other things, a narrative definition of land, of what limits the land, what the land means, who can determine all of these things in that location. One of the things that the state does is to make land legible in particular terms, in its particular terms. And because of the law and because of real estate, everybody, we all interact with the notion that the state is what gives land stability, and also the idea that the state is itself stable or is designed to have a certain sort of stability to it. And we are encouraged, or maybe coerced in various ways, to have a fairly passive relationship to land that is understood in state/market terms in this way. By looking closely at a location or environment, we bring ourselves in relation to that place, and we allow our own relationality to matter. The visual activity does, in some maybe subtle, maybe not so subtle way, complicate legible definitions of the land, because we see more than it. We see too much of what is going on. We don't just see the narrative of a land given by the state, we see a lot more than that that's going on. More generally, by doing an exercise like this, we can allow ourselves to consider a present time and place in which what we see matters. And we can begin like a dynamic, complex interaction with the place and maybe with each other if we do this type of activity together. And we may also see ways in which land or a location either exceeds or maybe underperforms the narrative definitions given by the state. So in the limits of like the coherence given to a place by a state, we see the limits or the changeability of state-associated paradigms such as value, utility, types of morality. We see the extent of these things, and then a lot of things that are not covered by those methods of understanding where we are. We also might see ways in which the state itself is maybe not such a stable entity, and some of the specific limits to its hard power. We may see ways in which the state actively destabilizes environments or is the manager of different kinds of destruction. We may see transitions happening in a place, covertly or overtly in an environment, directions yet untaken as a place continues to change. Very importantly, we see ambiguity. We see things that we actually can't identify at all and don't yet know what they are or what they are to us. So painting, this is a physical record of the activity of looking and listening. This is just one of many methods of looking slowly at environments. And I am kind of arguing that looking at environments, and also even just looking at images, are both methods of deciding what you see and coming up with your orientation to what you see. And I understand that painting specifically is an expenditure of time that may not be practical or suitable for everyone, but even if it's not, I still advocate at least kind of an occasional willingness to look and listen to your environment more slowly. And also, obviously, painting is not the most expedient way to communicate information, and it's not a substitute for other actions, but it can set the stage for relating to your environment in a different way by beginning to allow, like I said, what we see to matter. Obviously, painting kind of can and should be something other than like high-end money laundering. We don't have to buy into the concept of like art. It's just a way to see and to share things that are already real that we can see but may have been overlooked or missed. So I'm going to start by talking about the figurative approach to painting. I'm going to ask if has anybody done figurative painting, which means like you're using a reference, you're looking at something, and you're trying to, your goal is to convey likeness. For those who may not know, technique-wise, whether you're doing portraits or landscapes or still lives or whatever, the irony of doing that activity is that actually in order to get likeness, in order to make something look like what you're seeing, you actually have to like radically abstract the legible landmarks of the place. You have to stop seeing it as, oh, this is my house, and start seeing, okay, these are two angles that connect, these are different shades of things, different colors, and put different relationships together. And then you have to reassemble all of these, you have to see all these relationships, and then you have to reassemble them according to the principles of, one, degrees of sensitivity, how many relationships can you see in what you're looking at? Two, patience, how long are you willing or able to spend time actually looking at the thing? And three, your willingness to honor those relationships. In other words, like, not lie to yourself about what angle something rests at, not substitute what you think to see you see or what you want to see for what you actually do see. And are you willing to recognize what is really there rather than think, oh, my house is yellow, so I'm going to get the yellow paint out, when actually if you visually look at it, maybe the sun is setting and maybe it's brown. But if you have it in your mind that it's yellow, you're not going to get to likeness. So the entire technique of getting likeness from observation completely hinges on forcibly forgetting what you see and being willing to actually flat out ignore the like narrative identity of the thing you're looking at, including like the state imposed one. You have to just be able to see it as like purely just a bunch of colors and angles and shades. I did some figurative paintings for this conference, and I'm going to talk about them in terms of their, I guess, narrative identity with regard to the state, but I also want to be clear that the way that I'm engaging with, like, the narrative identity of these places, this is happening after I've done the exercise of staring at each place with its story, like, totally stripped away. The activity of painting figurative images of these places required me to completely abandon their, like, meaning and identity, even though in the end, of course, they're going to aspire to be, like, legible and recognizable afterwards. So even though these places nominally have different types of tension with their respective governing states, it feels very obvious to me, having painted them, that there are particular limits to the stability of those states, to say the least. There's gaps, there's tensions, and things are very visibly changing in a kind of complex set of ways. And after that, I'm going to talk about non-figurative painting, and honestly, this is my primary way of painting locations, which I've done for my whole adult life, and this really offers a slightly different type of observations, and I'm going to explain why I think the process of either making or looking at non-figurative images, people popularly call abstract, but I don't think that that's a, I don't know, helpful term, really. But the whole activity of making these images or looking at them offers, in my opinion, like particular relevance to the world in which we currently find ourselves. But first, figurative paintings. So I'm going to start talking about this image I did of the Florida Canal in New Orleans during a spring flood during 2024. This spot is less than a mile from my house, and I spent a lot of time at that place, but I also used some reference photos taken by my friend Kelsey McIntosh. in this image or that I painted, that it's flooded, and it wasn't flooded because of like a tropical storm or hurricane. It just rained for one day. It's a very kind of violently dynamic spot. I mean, I guess all land, in my opinion, is pretty violently dynamic, but there's a way in which New Orleans is, like, really showy about it. This canal, the Florida Canal, you know, any canal in a city, it's kind of a monument to the necessity of having a state to do stuff like have canals, to protect people and businesses from flooding, to control the flooding, to insulate the city from, like, the volatile climate and from water. And it, and ironically, also is functionally a monument to the unsolvability of these problems under the current state paradigm that we have, because the canal was damaged during Katrina. It's supposed to have a grade, like a slope, that leads to Lake Pontchartrain to make the water go out of the city and into the lake. But the weight of the water during Katrina sunk the grade, so it's actually just basically level or possibly even graded the wrong way. And so the canal does not do what it's supposed to do, which is to drain to the lake. And the state lacks the political will to fund fixing this, so it just kind of presides over these very predictable cycles of flood damage to the city. If the state existence of state-built and state-managed infrastructure is an example of the state giving land stability, then what does it mean that these canals, like, regularly flood so easily? It doesn't even take that, it's just, like, it rains for one day and this happens. And it's a clear-cut example of how people think about the state is kind of things like, the government should do something about this very predictable physical problem. And it really kind of is thought-provoking that what does it mean that the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, like, can't slash won't do anything to change it. Does this show the inability of the state to produce a stable reality? Or if there is stability, it's the stability of state overseen and managed destruction. Like, the term sacrifice zone gets kind of thrown around a lot in relation to New Orleans and places with similar, I don't know, climate-related cycles of destruction that continue to happen. We see neglect and disrepair, and, or just the disjuncture between what the local government claims to be for versus the reality that they're actually just this, yeah, custodian of destruction, and that they also function to prevent anyone else from being allowed to fix things in the immediate or in any kind of long-term planning way. And they also function, the state does, to preserve an opacity around people even understanding how the fuck water management in the city works. And it's kind of opaque by design. The notion is that the residents of the city, like, just don't worry about it. You shouldn't have to worry about it. We've got this, even though they, like, very clearly don't. And despite how consequential it is for every single area of New Orleans, the system of canals is so popularly opaque that even people in the Sewage and Water Board, they don't exhibit, like, understanding of the system. And it makes me ask, is it a system then? What does it mean for us that we cannot easily interact with even the knowledge about how water is controlled in the city, let alone try to find any kind of solutions beyond individual solutions such as sandbagging your house or parking your car on the median whenever it rains? I've observed that the city and the state, though, they don't actually do a very good job all the time of preventing people from fixing things for themselves. And there's a debate that this opens up about whether in Louisiana, the state to some degree relies on the assumption that people will just covertly solve problems for themselves and fix things. I mean, the state flag of Louisiana is this famously a pelican stabbing itself in the chest and feeding its young with its blood. And the point of that is self-reliance. So in some ways, they kind of have it built into the structure that they just, like, won't fix things, and people will, they'll just assume that everybody is gonna fucking fend for themselves. And that's not, like, necessarily this some sort of resistance to state control. It's sort of, like, a built-in assumption of how the state functions in specifically Louisiana. And this location is immediately across the road from the Sewage and Water Board facility headquarters, And this canal is partly managed by the Sujan Water Board, which is a public utility, which has been under siege for a long time from a desire to privatize it. Of course, privatization is this narrative that, oh yeah, the bureaucracy is the reason it's dysfunctional, and this will fix it, which they've attempted to do that in the past with the Sujan Water Board, and it failed, but there's still a lot of people that want that, and the purpose of privatization, as we know, is to pay employees less money and continue to deliver like the same amount of dysfunction, if not more so, and with less oversight and less recourse. And this has already happened in New Orleans with the energy company, and that's pretty much how it went. So the wreckage of flood damage in this way functions to set up the idea that the market could fix it. The government can't deal with it, and we know that that's also not true, and this is just kind of a run-of-the-mill neoliberal dynamic. Meanwhile, in several other ways, Louisiana as a state is actively in an acceleration that goes kind of beyond neoliberalism and is sort of just full-on self-destructing as even a neoliberal state, and is transforming into a more directly just feudal entity. In other words, it functions for policing and protecting like wealth and property, extracting rent through violence, and basically doing nothing else. Like, the schools and medical stuff, all of it is getting chipped away at or just sledgehammered. Anyway, those are some of my thoughts of that location. You will see probably in my image like a failure to produce likeness, and it's kind of a failure of technique because of a failure of seeing things as they actually are, and instead unconsciously nudging yourself towards what you're thinking about and what you expect to see. In my case, I think it's due to a long relationship with this site, which I think literally just distorted my ability to see the angles and colors accurately. Also, there's a lot of transition happening here. It can be different. This thing is already not what it was originally intended to be. It's physically changing, and therefore its meaning will keep changing. And the main agential entity here is the water. Okay, next I'm going to talk about the Massacre River Canal, which is a non-state building project in Haiti in 2023. I used a bunch of reference photos, but mainly one by somebody named Pierre-Michel Jean. Using photos is, side note, like a much more limited method of painting from observation. Even though the process is the same, it really creates a lot of limitations that, that's kind of a tangent though. I didn't know a lot about the situation and started reading about it because it seemed like an inspiring story and an interesting contrast regarding like the topic of canals, since I spend a lot of time thinking about the canals in New Orleans. If I understand it correctly, there's been a dispute about the Massacre River, which runs between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. There's like a long history of anti-Haitian racism in Dominican Republic, and this precipitated a conflict over the river. It was reported that 50,000 people showed up to physically build a canal so that they would be able to still irrigate parts of Haiti, and the materials were bought by people making donations. And I think that the Dominican Republic had threatened to cut off Haitian access to the river, and this is what provoked it in the first place. So this is like a population with no functioning government coordinating to meet their collective needs in opposition to a hostile state. And this had me thinking about the state's mean stability story regarding the Dominican Republic's stability, or stable ability to cause problems for Haiti and for the people living there, contrasting with the solidity of a collective project at this scale. Because I live surrounded by so much broken, insufficient, or harmful physical infrastructure, it's very interesting to me to imagine situations in which people take the agency to coordinate infrastructural improvements. I tried to imagine 50,000 Americans showing up to do anything whatsoever, maybe watch sports. Even mass mobilizations of my lifetime in the United States have not engaged with the tangible physical world in this consequentially. And this seems like it's obviously due to a complete lack of awareness, if not a hostile rejection of any concept of collective needs, collective well-being, collective struggle. In the U.S., this viewpoint that we have a collective intertwined existence at all is generally only encountered in like niche marginal populations like us here in this room. because Haiti is so often narrativized first and foremost in terms of its inability, in particular on the very clear-cut basis of not having a functioning state government as such, it is remarkable to me how effectively coordinated this project seemed. I suspect that we in the U.S. have an incredible amount to learn from Haitians in particular about how to engage with our living environment agentially and acting on some version of collectivity. And in this painting, the houses were too fuzzy and inaccessible for me to see just from a photo alone, but I do know what rebar looks like, having done some concrete work before. And I was thinking a lot about the rocks and about the Caribbean climate. New Orleans is often said to be the northmost Caribbean city. So I guess I was looking for points of connection, trying to see something. And again, I think that this limited the execution of the image itself too. And then finally, these two images of the Warren, the building that this talk is taking place in Evansville, while it's under construction in 2023-2024. And these had me thinking about ways we try to assemble and congeal something as simple as a functioning building in a hostile political environment, hostile to many things, but what I mostly mean is that the local government is very openly hostile to use of space for anything other than private commerce. We can see the image, clutter. The material complexity of swimming against the current to make this building or any site something else other than an investment property. The dynamism of a place that's a work in progress, actively undergoing a transition. The building looks so different on different sides that it's not recognizable as the same building in these two paintings. The end version is by nature going to be this heterogeneous patchwork of different materials from different sources, and it's been constructed in these like rapidly changing and fairly stressful circumstances. And we can probably visually see the effects of all the rules that had to be confronted, negotiated, bended, fought, appeased in a million little ways. And what that looks like is a layers effect of like different phases on the building itself. Its walls are made of different, the siding is different on different places. Its structure is just very heterogeneous. And the aesthetic qualities of heterogeneity or like a patchwork look on buildings tends to exist, in my opinion, as like the antithesis of the neoliberal real estate aesthetic. Think like the Apple Store or downtown Evansville that looks like CGI come to life, and it was just obviously designed on a computer. If you've walked or driven around downtown Evansville, it's like comical, the aesthetic will that is in effect there. The more organic and chaotic look of these buildings is the material effect of like a different relational outlook and orientation to space itself. To be subject to circumstances rather than to aesthetically broadcast, this is an institution that is not subject to any uncertainty and is a frictionless execution of plans. Instead, this building is visibly a product of friction, of a set of decisions made by people to face into various kinds of material / legal / energetic friction. Instead of trying to obscure friction or flee from it by leaning into the pre-existing definition of what land / property is supposed to be. The process of making this building happen was, at a minimum, fighting the state structure locally by way of code enforcement, the ongoing fight with code enforcement. Are the people who built this building winning? Maybe to some extent, maybe not to some extent. Fighting the market forces that the state enacts and the suppression of all resistance to just like real estate as the defining principle for all buildings and land. The ways that our time and energy are siphoned away from building what we want to build, the cheese grater effect of stress on social relationality, and the horizontal effects of like neighbors maybe becoming deputized agents of the state / market sensibility in different ways. Returning to the more general topic of figurative images and narrative, even though when you're looking at something you have to radically abstract the image to get likeness, afterwards you can reinduce, or actually while you're planning a painting, you can reintroduce narrative identity or think about it through composition, i.e. like where you put everything, what visual angle you choose to be painting from. In these images, I wanted to get the experience and like convey the fact that you can't see the whole shape of it from one perspective, and that, as I said, it's like not recognizable as the same building in two different images from two sides, because the friction shaping it is so high that it's very heterogeneous looking. Also, smallness. I kind of made the decision to do it small so that you really have to come up close to see it, and you have to make the decision to approach it. I don't think that that's like the best way to plan it, but that's just what I did in this case. Narrative, often in the form of like symbolism, will be squeezed out of an image by interpretation, whether or not you intend to think of it that way. I'm personally not very interested in usage of symbolism. If I'm trying to focus on narratives, I'd probably write about something rather than paint. But many people do engage with images primarily this way. I encourage people to experiment with ignoring the narrative dimension until after you're done painting, so that it doesn't limit what you see quite so much. And as a side note, some people want, in the realm of like political struggle, to specifically build like a figurative legibility, like a story of like who we are, and that we all are this kind of same position for the purpose of unifying. And legible narratives do have a unifying effect to some degree, and there's like a power with that. But even if we are trying to do this, which maybe not everybody is, you still have to start by deciding to see a world in different terms than its like default face value legibility. I'm going to move on to talking about the non-figurative approach, which, and producing non-figurative images, and ask, has anybody done this? If you do this, do you use a specific subject? Instead of suspending the narrative lens in order to abstract the elements of an environment like you would do in a figurative painting, working with non-figurative images asks you to deal with like an overwhelming volume of possible observations and narratives, possible depictions, and make confident limiting decisions about what you care to see or what you are looking for. The subject of, if you're doing locations of a non-figurative image, it functions more as a starting place, but instead of using the techniques of faithfully rendering what you see, instead you will respond to the image itself, like listen to the image, be willing to try to tell maybe what it wants, what you want from it, including deciding what moves to make and when to stop making moves, and to treat it like something communicative in and of itself, that treat the painting that way. You have to select one move at a time out of kind of infinite possibilities with very little rational guidance beyond use paint to change the image or decide to stop. And the most important thing about this to me is having patience and endurance of ambiguity and a certain amount of confidence working with ambiguous situations. In this ways, I think it's an exercise with that has some relevance and applications in other areas of political engagement, when you have to really endure a lot of ambiguity and be comfortable with that. In situations where we lack a fully rational or coherent set of guidelines, where we're in uncharted territory and have to rely on endurance of ambiguity, we have to get in the habit of trying to see the thread that we want to follow. It can be helpful to take some time to decide how you will decide what you're looking at. And it's a lot harder for people to do this if ambiguity is something that we find boring or that we're scared of or that makes us nervous. How do we select a thread? Ideally, with your people, with other people, in an otherwise oversaturated and overwhelming field of possibilities that's so chaotic that it risks being totally opaque to us. Practicing endurance of ambiguity allows us to not let outcomes be predetermined by the state, where the state would potentially be like the strongest gravity field and source of coherence and meaning, I guess. I think that this activity parallels and kind of opens the question of how do we decide what to do? Where do we put our efforts in our world? What is our rubric for success? How do we see what we even want? Do we rely on passively received reflexes like maximizing our money or a certain system of morality, etc.? Or do we try to examine our reflexes, maybe change them, maybe collaboratively develop new sensibilities with other people? So I really recommend non-figurative painting, and I suggest that it's like a means of looking at the aesthetic dimension of your environment and just practice trial and error your way through developing an approach. These actions are not only operative in making non-figurative images, but also in looking at them. When something is presented as non-figurative, it's easier for us to decide to see something in them. In other words, to relate to what it means to us as observers, so relational meaning, and not whether it is or isn't a legible, exemplary figuration of something, like a model of goodness or whatever. But also many people have a profound distrust of their own vision, and in the realm of images, or especially things that are cast as art, people default to, like, the Emperor's New Clothes principle. So, like, if other people are accepting this, then it probably must be good, and I don't have to acknowledge that I think that it looks like bullshit. And this is one reason that engaging with non-figurative images can function as a practice of reconnecting to, like, a non-rational subjectivity and a relational mode of interpretation. So, decide what you see, what to see when too many things could be seen, decide whether you hate it or like it, and why. Use these observations as a starting point for looking at your environment with the same confidence. I really believe that looking at the aesthetic dimension of environments is a very powerful method of uncovering buried dynamics and buried ways of that things affect us. Producing and sharing illegible figures and illegible structures is a powerful way to practice this as well. The process is similarly simple and accessible as, like, looking into clouds and seeing dicks, or looking at the produce in the grocery store and seeing piles of faces, or going to an Airbnb and feeling like, oh, damn, this place is ugly, or this place is really beautiful, and why? And this is particularly powerful to do with others because it makes us aware that we will not all just automatically see the same thing in anything, and that when we come together in a shared will, it's because we have made a shared decision. We have together decided to hone in on the same observations, and it's not because of some automatic phenomena or, like, passively shared identity. It's because of decision. And to relate to an environment as a collectivity with other people requires us to make the decision to find a basis for collectivity, always starting from a place of, like, subjective separation. So in conclusion, to make a figurative image of a place, you first suspend the story of what is the place, spend the time to relate to the place visually, and focus on seeing visual relationships in that spot. Any narrative interpretation will get in the way of achieving likeness, even though when we look at the image after completion, we will largely be looking for a legible narrative and identity. But the activity of painting it will have opened up the range of what we're willing to see. To make a non-figurative image of a place, you have to spend time relating to not only the place, but other non-visual dimensions of the place, including an onslaught of possible narratives of what is this place and what is this place to us. You have to endure an extended confrontation with ambiguity and continually make often contradictory decisions about which visual arrangements are important to you and which ones you're willing to destroy. Non-figurative images are an encounter with what it can look like when we give up legibility, like we sidestep it, or we lose it through failure, or we pursue something that will be legible but in totally different terms. I want to say a word about destructiveness. Every time you make a new move to change your image, this is true in both modalities, it destroys the previous image of it. And this is another element of why I think painting is a good exercise. I meet a lot of people who aren't even comfortable destroying an arrangement on a piece of paper, and I think that this is connected to how daunting and impossible it feels for people to really imagine physically changing your environment. Like, if you can barely be comfortable messing up something that is just so low stakes as an image, then no wonder people are very kind of daunted by the idea of really changing how their environment functions, making physical changes to it. So that's part of why I think that this kind of destructive activity allows us to practice forming a relationship with irreversible change, something that many people are kind of conditioned to be afraid of, and with the risk that it entails to be working with this stuff. So the relational gesture, the decision to see your environment as something you are related to, in my opinion, is accessible from everywhere through even just visually looking around, even if you don't paint a picture of what you see. Even just visually looking opens you up to the possibility and the complexity of seeing something in totally different terms than you may have otherwise been willing to look for. And finally, once again, making images is not a substitute for other practices. I mean it to be a complementary endeavor. My purpose has not been to conflate making images with making physical changes to our environments, but rather to just make the case for time spent relating to environments in a more open-ended, relational, and patient way. And that's the end of my talk for now.